Domesday Book, Cassette 7.
Transcript from the Domesday Book. 19th of December, 1320, Old Style. I'm feeling better. I can go 3 or 4 careful breaths at a time without coughing. And I was actually hungry this morning, though not for the greasy porridge Masery brought me. I would kill for a plate of bacon and eggs. And a bath. I am absolutely filthy. Nothing's been washed since I got here except my forehead. And the last 2 days, Lady Imani has glued poultices made of strips of linen covered with a disgusting-smelling paste to my chest. Between that, the intermittent sweats that I'm still having, and the bed, which hasn't been changed since the 1200s, I positively reek, and my hair, short as it is crawling. I'm the cleanest person here. Dr. Ahrens was right in wanting to cauterize my nose. Everyone, even the little girls, smell terrible, and it's the dead of winter and freezing cold in here. I can't imagine what it must be like in August. They all have fleas. Lady Imani stops even in mid-prayer to scratch. And when Agnes pulled down her hose to show me her knee, there were red bites all up and down her leg. Eloise, Imani, and Rosamond have comparatively clean faces. But they don't wash their hands, even after emptying the chamber pot. And the idea of washing the dishes or changing the flock in the mattresses has yet to be invented. By rights, they should all have long since died of infection. But except for scurvy and a lot of bad teeth, everyone seems to be in good health. Even Agnes's knee is healing nicely. She comes to show me the scab every day, and her silver buckle, and her wooden knight, and poor overloved Blackie. She is a treasure trove of information. Most of it volunteered without my even asking. Rosamond is in her 13th year, which means she's 12, and the room they've been tending me in is her bower. It's hard to imagine she'll soon be of marriageable age, and thus has a private maiden's bower. The girls were frequently married at 14 and 15 in the 1300s. Eloise can scarcely have been older than that when she married. Agnes also told me she has 3 older brothers, all of whom stayed in Bath with their father. The bell in the southwest is Swindone. Agnes can name all the bells by the sound of their ringing. The distant one that always rings first is the Osney bell, the forerunner of Great Tom. The double bells are at Courcy, where Sir Blowett lives, and the 2 closest are Whitney and Estcott. That means I'm close to Skengate in location, and this could very well be Skengate. It has the ash trees, it's about the right size, and the church is in the right place. Miss Montoya may simply not have found the bell tower yet. Unfortunately, the name of the village is the one thing Agnes hasn't known. She did know where Garwin was. She told me he was out hunting my attackers. And when he finds them, he will slay them with his sword like that, she said, demonstrating with Blackie. I'm not certain the things she tells me can always be depended upon. She told me King Edward is in France, and that Father Roche saw the devil dressed all in black and riding on a black stallion. This last is possible, that Father Roche told her that, not that he saw the devil. The line between the spiritual world and the physical wasn't clearly drawn until the Renaissance, and the contemps routinely saw visions of angels, the Last Judgment, the Virgin Mary. Lady Imani complains constantly about how ignorant and illiterate and incompetent Father Roche is. She is still trying to convince Eloise to send Garwin to Osney to fetch a monk. When I asked her if she would send for him so he could pray with me, I decided that request couldn't possibly be considered overbold. He gave me a half-hour recital of how he had forgotten part of the venite, had blown the candles out instead of pinching them so that much wax is wasted, and filled the servants' heads with superstitious prate, no doubt of the devil and his horse. Village-level priests in the 1300s were merely peasants who'd been taught the mass by rote and a smattering of Latin. Everyone smells about the same to me, but the nobility viewed their serfs as a different species altogether, and I'm sure it offends Hermione's aristocratic soul to have to tell her confession to this villain. He's no doubt as superstitious and illiterate as she claims, but he's not incompetent. He held my hand when I was dying. He told me not to be afraid. And I wasn't. Break. I'm feeling better by leaps and bounds. This afternoon I sat up for half an hour, and tonight I went downstairs for supper. Lady Eloise brought me a brown Wadmore kirtle and mustard-coloured surcoat to wear, and a sort of kerchief to cover my chopped-off hair. Not a wimple and coif, so Eloise must still think I'm a maiden in spite of all Hermione's talk about adulteresses. I don't know if my clothes were inappropriate or simply too nice to be worn for every day. Eloise didn't say anything. She and Hermione helped me dress. I wanted to ask if I could wash before I put my new clothes on, but I'm afraid of doing anything that will make Hermione more suspicious. She watched me fasten my points and tie my shoes, as it was, and kept a sharp eye on me all through dinner. I sat between the girls and shared a trencher with them. The steward was relegated to the very end of the table, and Masri was nowhere to be seen. According to Mr. Latimer, the parish priest ate at the Lord's table. But Lady Hermione probably doesn't like Father Roche's table manners either. We had meat, I think venison, and bread. The venison tasted of cinnamon, salt, and the lack of refrigeration, and the bread was stone hard, but it was better than porridge. And I don't think I made any mistakes. Though I'm certain I must be making mistakes all the time, and that's why Lady Hermione is so suspicious of me. My clothes, my hands, probably my sentence structure, are slightly, or not so slightly, off. And it all combines to make me seem foreign, peculiar, suspicious. Lady Eloise is too worried over her husband's trial to notice my mistakes, and the girls are too young. But Lady Hermione notices everything, and is probably making a list like the one she has for Father Roche. Thank goodness I didn't tell her I was Isabel de Beauvier. She'd have ridden to Yorkshire, winter or no, to catch me out. Garwin came in after dinner. Masri, who'd finally slunk in with a scarlet ear and a wooden bowl of ale, had dragged the benches over to the hearth and put several logs of fat pine on the fire, and the women were sewing by its yellow light. Garwin stopped in front of the screens, obviously just in from a hard ride, and for a minute no one noticed him. Rosamond was brooding over her embroidery. Agnes was pushing her cart back and forth with a wooden knight in it. And Eloise was talking earnestly to Hermione about the cotter, who apparently isn't doing very well. The smoke from the fire was making my chest hurt, and I turned my head away from it, trying to keep from coughing, and saw him standing there, looking at Eloise. After a moment, Agnes ran her cart into Hermione's foot, and Hermione told her she was the devil's own child, and Garwin came on into the hall. I lowered my eyes and prayed he would speak to me. He did, bowing on one knee in front of where I sat on the bench.
"Good lady," he said. "I am glad to see you improved."
I had no idea what, if anything, was appropriate to say. I ducked my head lower. He remained on one knee like a servitor.
I was told you remember naught of your attackers, Lady Catherine. Is it so?
Yes,
I murmured. Nor of your servants, where they might have fled.
I shook my head, eyes still downcast. He turned toward Eloise.
I have news of the renegades, Lady Eloise. I have found their trail. There were many of them, and they had horses.
I'd been afraid he was going to say he'd caught some poor wood-gathering peasant and hanged him.
I beg your leave to pursue them and avenge the lady, he said, looking at Eloise.
Eloise looked uneasy, wary, the way she had when he came before. My husband bade us keep to this place till he comes, she said. And he bade you stay with us to guard us. Nay.
You have not supped, Lady Imani said, in a tone that closed the matter.
Garwin stood up. I thank you for your kindness, sir, I said rapidly. I know it was you who found me in the woods.
I took a breath and coughed.
I beg you, will you tell me of the place you found me, where it is?
I had tried to say too much too fast. I began to cough, gasped too deep a breath, and doubled over with the pain. By the time I got the coughing under control, Imani had set meat and cheese on the table for Garwin, and Eloise had gone back to her sewing. So I still don't know anything.
No, that's not true.
I know why Eloise looked so wary when he came in and why he made up a tale about a band of renegades and what that conversation about Daltresses was all about. I watched him standing there in the doorway looking at Eloise, and I didn't need an interpreter to read his face. He's obviously in love with his lord's wife. Chapter 14 Dunworthy slept straight through till morning.
Your secretary wanted to wake you up, but I wouldn't let him, Colin said. He said to give you these.
He thrust a messy sheaf of papers at him.
What time is it?
Dunworthy said, sitting up stiffly in bed.
8:30, Colin said. All the bell ringers and DTs are in hall eating breakfast.
Oatmeal.
He made a gagging sound. It was absolutely necrotic. Your secretary chap says we need to ration the eggs and bacon because of the quarantine.
8:30 in the morning?
Dunworthy asked, blinking nearsightedly at the window. It was as dark and dismal as when he'd fallen asleep.
Good Lord. I was supposed to have gone back to hospital to question Badri.
I know, Colin said. Great Aunt Mary said to let you sleep, that you couldn't question him anyway, because they're running tests.
She rang up?
Dunworthy asked, groping blindly for his spectacles on the bedstand.
I went over this morning to have my blood tested. Great Aunt Mary said to tell you we only need to come once a day for our blood tests.
He hooked his spectacles over his ears and looked at Colin.
Did she say whether they'd identified the virus?
Colin said, around a lump in his cheek. Dunworthy wondered if the gobstopper had been in his mouth all night, and if so, why it hadn't diminished in size.
She sent you the contacts chart.
He handed the papers to him.
The lady we saw at the infirmary rang up too. The one on the bicycle.
Montoya?
Yes. She wanted to know if you knew how to get in touch with Mr. Bazingame's wife. I told her you'd ring her back. When does the post come, do you know?
The post? Dunworthy said, looking through the stack.
My mother didn't have my presents brought in time to send them on the tube with me, Colin said. She said she'd send them by post. You don't think the quarantine will delay it, do you?
Some of the papers Colin had handed him were stuck together. No doubt because of Colin's periodic examinations of his gobstopper, and most of them seemed to be not the contact charts, but assorted memoranda from Finch. One of the heating vents in Sulvin was stuck shut. The National Health Service ordered all inhabitants of Oxford and environs to avoid contact with infected persons. Mrs. Basingham was in Torquay for Christmas. They were running very low on lavatory paper.
You don't, do you? Think it will delay it? Colin asked.
Delay what? Dunworthy said.
The post, Colin said disgustedly. The quarantine won't delay it, will it? What time is it supposed to come?
10, Dunworthy said. He sorted all the memoranda into one pile and opened a large manila envelope.
It's usually a bit late at Christmas because of all the parcels and Christmas cards.
The stapled sheets in the envelope weren't the contact charts either. They were William Gadsden's report on Badri's and Kivrin's whereabouts, neatly typed and organized into the morning, afternoon, and evening of each day. It looked far neater than any essay he'd ever handed in. Amazing what a salutary influence a mother could have.
I don't see why it should be, Colin said. I mean, it's not as if it's people, is it? So it can't be contagious. Where does it come? To the hall?
What?
The post.
Porter's Lodge, Dunworthy said, reading the report on Badri. He had gone back to the net Tuesday afternoon after he was at Balliol. Finch had spoken to him at 2 o'clock, when he had asked where Mr. Dunworthy was, and again at a little before 3 when Badri had given him the note. At some time between 2 and 3, John Yee, the third-year student, had seen him cross the quad to the laboratory, apparently looking for someone. At 3, the porter at Bray's Nose had logged Badri in. He had worked in the net until 7:30, and then gone back to his flat and dressed for the dance. Dunworthy phoned Latimer.
When were you at the net Tuesday afternoon?
He blinked bewilderedly at Dunworthy from the screen.
Tuesday?
He said, looking around as if he had mislaid something.
Was that yesterday?
The day before the drop, Dunworthy said. You went to the Bodleian in the afternoon. He nodded.
She wanted to know how to say, help me, for I have been set upon by thieves.
Dunworthy assumed by she he meant Kivrin.
Did Kivrin meet you at the Bodleian or at Bray's Nose?
He put his hand to his chin, pondering.
We had to work until late in the evening deciding on the form of the pronouns, he said. The decay of pronominal inflections was advanced in the 1300s, but not complete.
Did Kivrin come to the net to meet you?
The net?
Latimer said doubtfully.
To the laboratory at Bray's Nose, Dunworthy snapped.
Bray's Nose? The Christmas Eve service isn't at Bray's Nose, is it?
The Christmas Eve service?
The vicar said he wished me to read the benediction, Latimer said. Is it being held at Bray's Nose?
No. You met with Kivrin Tuesday afternoon to work on her speech. Where did you meet her?
The word thieves was very difficult to translate. It derives from the old English theop. But the... This was useless.
The Christmas Eve service is at St. Mary the Virgin's at 7, he said, and rang off.
He phoned the porter at Bray's Nose, who was still decorating his tree, and made him look up Kivrin in his logbook. She hadn't been there Tuesday afternoon.
He fed the contact charts into the console and entered the additions from William's report. Kivrin hadn't seen Badri Tuesday. Tuesday morning she'd been in infirmary and then with Dunworthy. Tuesday afternoon she'd been with Latimer, and Badri would have been gone to the dance in Headington before they left the Bodleian. Monday, from 3 on, she was in infirmary. But there was still a gap between 12 and 2:30 on Monday, when she might have seen Badri. He scanned the contact sheets they had filled out again. Montoya's was only a few lines long. She had filled in her contacts for Wednesday morning, but none for Monday and Tuesday, and she hadn't listed any information on Badri. He wondered why, and then remembered she had come in after Mary gave the instructions for filling up the forms. Perhaps Montoya had seen Badri before Wednesday morning, or knew where he'd spent the gap between noon and 2:30 on Monday.
When Miss Montoya phoned, did she tell you her telephone number?
He asked Colin. There was no answer. He looked up.
Colin?
He wasn't in the room, nor in the sitting room, though his duffel was, its contents spread all over the carpet. Dunworthy looked up Montoya's number at Brasenose and rang it up, not expecting any answer. If she was still looking for Basingham, that meant she hadn't gotten permission to go out to the dig and was doubtless at the NHS or the National Trust, badgering them to have it declared of irreplaceable value. He dressed and went across to the hall, looking for Colin. It was still raining, the sky the same sodden grey as the paving stones and the bark on the beech trees. He hoped that the bell ringers and detainees had breakfasted early and gone back to their assigned rooms, but it was a fond hope. He could hear the high hubbub of female voices before he was halfway across the quad.
Thank goodness you're here, sir,
Finch said, meeting him at the door.
The NHS just phoned. They want us to take 20 more detainees.
Tell them we can't,
Dunworthy said, looking through the crowd.
We're under orders to avoid contact with infected persons.
Have you seen Dr. Aaron's nephew?
He was just here, Finch said, peering over the heads of the women. But Dunworthy had already spotted him. He was standing at the end of the table where the bell ringers were sitting, buttering several pieces of toast. Dunworthy made his way to him.
When Miss Montoya telephoned, did she tell you where she might be reached?
The one with the bicycle, Colin said, smearing marmalade on the buttered toast.
Yes.
No. She didn't.
Will you have breakfast, sir? Finch said. I'm afraid there aren't any bacon and eggs, and we're getting very low on marmalade.
He glared at Colin.
But there's oatmeal and...
Just tea, Dunworthy said. She didn't mention where she was phoning from.
Do sit down, Miss Taylor said. I've been wanting to speak to you about our Chicago surprise.
What exactly did Miss Montoya say?
Dunworthy said to Colin.
That nobody cared that her dig was being ruined, and an invaluable link with the past was being lost, and what sort of person went fishing in the middle of winter anyway?
Colin said, scraping marmalade off the sides of the bowl.
We're nearly out of tea,
Finch said, pouring Dunworthy a very pale cup. Dunworthy sat down.
Would you like some cocoa, Colin? Or a glass of milk?
Dunworthy asked.
We're nearly out of milk, Finch said.
I don't need anything, thanks, Colin said, slapping the slices of toast jam sides together. I'm just going to take these with me out to the gate so I can wait for the post.
The vicar telephoned, Finch said. He said to tell you you needn't be there to go over the order of worship until 6:30.
Are they still holding the Christmas Eve service? Dunworthy said.
I shouldn't think anyone would come under the circumstances.
He said the inter-church committee had voted to hold it regardless, Finch said, pouring a quarter teaspoon of milk in the pallid tea and handing it to him. He said they felt carrying on as usual will help keep up morale. We're going to perform several pieces on the handbells, Miss Taylor said. It's hardly a substitute for a peal, of course, but it's something. The priest from Holy Reformed is going to read from the Mass in time of pestilence.
Ah, Dunworthy said. That should help in keeping up morale.
Do I have to go? Colin said.
He has no business going out in this weather, Mrs. Gadsden said, appearing like a harpy with a large bowl of grey oatmeal. She set it in front of Colin.
And no business being exposed to germs in a draughty church. He can stay here with me during the church service.
She pushed a chair up behind him. Sit down and eat your oatmeal.
Colin looked beseechingly at Dunworthy.
Colin, I left Miss Montoya's telephone number in my rooms, Dunworthy said. Would you fetch it for me?
Yes, Colin said, and was out of his chair like a shot.
When that child comes down with the Indian flu, Mrs. Gadsden said, I hope you will remember that you were the one who encouraged him in his poor eating habits. It is clear to me what led to this epidemic. Poor nutrition and a complete lack of discipline. It's disgraceful, the way this college is run. I asked to be put in with my son William, but instead I've been assigned a room in another building altogether, and...
I'm afraid you'll have to take that up with Finch, Dunworthy said.
He stood up and wrapped Colin's marmalade toast in a napkin.
I'm needed at the infirmary, he said,
and escaped before Mrs. Gadsden could start off again. He went back to his rooms and rang up Andrews. The line was engaged. He rang up the dig, on the off chance that Montoya had obtained her quarantine waiver, but there was no answer. He rang up Andrews again. Amazingly enough, the line was free. It rang three times, and then switched to a message service.
This is Mr. Dunworthy, he said.
He hesitated and then gave the number of his rooms.
I need to speak with you immediately. It's important.
He rang off, pocketed the disc, picked up his umbrella and Colin's toast, and walked out through the quad. Colin was huddling under the shelter of the gate, looking anxiously down the street towards Carfax.
I'm going to the infirmary to see my tech and your great aunt, Dunworthy said, handing him the napkin-wrapped toast. Would you like to go with me?
No, thanks, Colin said. I don't want to miss the post.
Well, for goodness sake, go and fetch your jacket so Mrs. Gadsden doesn't come out and begin haranguing you.
The gallstone's already been, Colin said. She tried to make me put on a muffler. A muffler! He gave another anxious look down the street. I ignored her.
I hadn't thought of that, Dunworthy said. I shall be home in time for lunch. If you need anything, ask Finch.
Colin said, obviously not listening. Dunworthy wondered what his mother was sending that merited such devotion. Obviously not a muffler. He pulled his own muffler up around his neck and set off for infirmary through the rain. There were only a few people in the streets, and they kept out of each other's way, one woman stepping off the pavement altogether to avoid meeting Dunworthy. Without the carillon banging away at It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, one would have had no idea at all that it was Christmas Eve. No one carried gifts or holly. No one carried parcels at all. It was as if the quarantine had knocked the memory of Christmas out of their heads completely. Well, and hadn't it? He hadn't given a thought to shopping for gifts or a tree. He thought of Colin huddled at Balliol's gate and hoped his mother at least hadn't forgotten to send his gift.
On the way home, he'd stop and get Colin a small present. A toy, or a vid or something. Something besides a muffler. At the infirmary, he was hustled immediately into isolation and taken off to question the new cases. It's essential we establish an American connection, Mary said. There's been a snag at the WIC. There's no one on duty who can run a sequencing because of the holidays. They're supposed to be at full readiness at all times, of course, but apparently it's after Christmas that they usually get problems. Food poisoning and overindulgence masquerading as viruses. So they give time off before. At any rate, the CDC in Atlanta agreed to send the vaccine prototype to the WIC without a positive S-ident. But they can't begin manufacturing without a definite connection. She led him down a cordoned off corridor. The cases are all following the profile of the South Carolina virus. High fever, body aches, secondary pulmonary complications, but unfortunately, that's not proof. She stopped outside a ward. You didn't find any American connections for Badri, did you? No. But there are still a good many gaps. Do you want me to question him as well? She hesitated. He's worse, Dunworthy said. He's developed pneumonia. I don't know if he'll be able to tell you anything. His fever is still very high, which follows the profile. We have him on the antimicrobials and adjuvants which the South Carolina virus responded to. She opened the door to the ward. The chart lists all the cases which have come in. Ask the nurse on duty which bed they're in. She typed something into the console by the first bed. It lit up a chart as branching and intertwined as the big beach in the quad. You don't mind having Colin with you for another night, do you?
I don't mind in the slightest.
Oh, good. I doubt very much I'll be able to get home before tomorrow, and I do worry about him staying alone in the flat. I'm apparently the only one who does, however, she said angrily. I finally got through to Deirdre down in Kent, and she wasn't even concerned. Oh, is there a quarantine on? She said. I've been so rushed I haven't had time to catch the news. And then she proceeded to tell me all about her and her living's plans, with the clear implication that she'd have had no time at all for Colin, and was glad she was rid of him. There are times when I'm convinced she's not my niece.
Did she send Colin's Christmas presents, do you know? He said she planned to send them by post. I'm certain she's been far too rushed to remember to buy them, let alone send them. The last time Colin was with me for Christmas, his gift didn't arrive till Epiphany. Oh, which reminds me, do you know what's become of my shopping bag? It had my gift for Colin in it.
I've got it at Balliol, he said.
Oh, good. I didn't finish my shopping, but if you'd wrap up the muffler and the other things, he'll have something under the tree, won't he? She stood up. If you find any possible connection, come tell me immediately. As you can see, we've already traced several of the secondaries to Badri, but those may only be cross connections, and the real connection could be someone else.
She left. And he sat down beside the bed of the woman of the lavender umbrella.
Miss Breen, he said. I'm afraid I must ask you some questions.
Her face was very red, and her breathing sounded like Badri's. But she answered his questions promptly and clearly. No, she hadn't been to America in the past month. No, she didn't know any Americans or anyone who'd been to America. But she had taken the tube up from London to shop for the day. At Blackwell's, you know. And she had been all over Oxford shopping, and then at the tube station, and there were at least 500 people she had had contact with who might be the connection Mary was looking for. It took him till past 2 to finish questioning the primaries and adding the contacts to the chart,
none of which were the American connection, though he had found out that two more of them had been to the dance in Headington. He went up to isolation, though he didn't have much hope of Badrice being able to answer his questions. But Badrice seemed improved. He was sleeping when Dunworthy came in, but when Dunworthy touched his hand, his eyes opened and focused on him.
"Mr. Dunworthy," he said.
His voice was weak and hoarse.
"What are you doing here?"
Dunworthy sat down. "How are you feeling?"
"It's odd, the things one dreams. I thought I had such a headache."
"I need to ask you some questions, Badrice. Do you remember who you saw at the dance you went to in Headington?"
"There were so many people,"
he said, and swallowed as if his throat hurt.
"I didn't know most of them."
"Do you remember who you danced with?"
"Elizabeth,"
he said, and it came out a croak.
"Sister somebody. I don't know her last name,"
he whispered.
"And Elizabeth Yakamoto."
The grim-looking ward sister came in. "Time for your x-ray," she said, without looking at Badrice. "You'll have to leave, Mr. Dunworthy." "Could I have just a few more minutes? It's important," he asked, but she was already tapping keys on the console. He leaned over the bed. "Badrice, when you got the fix, how much slippage was there?" "Mr. Dunworthy," the sister said insistently. Dunworthy ignored her. "Was there more slippage than you expected?"
"No,"
Badrice said huskily. He put his hand to his throat. "How much slippage was there?"
4 hours,
Badrice whispered, and Dunworthy let himself be ushered out. 4 hours. Kivrin had gone through at 12:30. That would have put her there at 4:30, nearly sunset, but still enough light left to see where she was, enough time to have walked to Skengate if necessary. He went to find Mary and give her the two names of the girls Badrice had danced with. Mary checked them against the list of new admissions. Neither of them were on it, and Mary told him he could go home and took his temps and blood so he wouldn't have to come back. He was about to start home when they brought Sizu Fairchild in. He didn't make it home till nearly tea time. Colin wasn't at the gate nor in hall, where Finch was nearly out of sugar and butter. "Where's Dr. Aaron's nephew?" Dunworthy asked him. "He waited by the gate all morning," Finch said, anxiously counting over sugar cubes. "The post didn't come till 1:00, and then he went over to his great-aunt's flat to see if the parcels had been sent there. I gather they hadn't. He came back looking very glum, and then about 30 minutes ago he said suddenly, 'I just thought of something,' and shot out. Perhaps he's thought of some other place the parcels might have been sent to." "But weren't," Dunworthy thought. "What time do the shops close today?" he asked Finch. "Christmas Eve." "Oh, they've already closed, sir. They always close early on Christmas Eve, and some of them closed at noon due to the lack of trade. I've a number of messages, sir. They'll have to wait," Dunworthy said, snatched up his umbrella and went out again. Finch was right. The shops were all closed. He went down to Blackwell's, thinking they had surely stayed open, but they were shut up tight. They had already taken advantage of the selling points of the situation, though. In the window, arranged amid the snow-covered houses of the toy Victorian village, were self-help medical books, drug compendia, and a brightly coloured paperback entitled Laughing Your Way to Perfect Health. He finally found an open post office off the high, but it had only cigarettes, cheap sweets, and a rack of greeting cards. Nothing in the way of suitable gifts for 12-year-old boys. He went out without buying anything, and then went back and purchased a pound's worth of toffee, a gobstopper the size of a small asteroid, and several packets of a sweet that looked like soap tablets. It wasn't much, but Mary had said she'd bought some other things. The other things turned out to be a pair of grey woolen socks, even grimmer than the muffler, and a vocabulary improvement vid. There were crackers, at least, and sheets of wrapping paper. But a pair of socks and some toffee hardly made a Christmas. He looked around the study, trying to think what he had that might do. Colin had said apocalyptic when Dunworthy had told him Kivrin was in the Middle Ages. He pulled down The Age of Chivalry. It only had illustrations, no hollows, but it was the best he could do on short notice. He wrapped it and the rest of the presents hastily, changed his clothes, and hurried over to St. Mary the Virgin's in a downpour, ducking across the deserted courtyard of the Bodleian and trying to avoid the spilling gutters. No one in their right mind would come out in this. Last year the weather had been dry and the church was still only half full. Kivrin had gone with him. She had stayed up for the vat to study, and he had found her in the Bodleian and insisted on her coming to his sherry party and then to church. "I shouldn't be doing this," she'd said on the way to the church. "I should be doing research."
"You can do it at St. Mary the Virgin's. Built in 1139 and all just as it was in the Middle Ages, including the heating system."
"The inter-church service is authentic too, I suppose," she'd said.
"I have no doubt that in spirit it is as well meant and as fraught with foolishness as any medieval mass," he had said.
He hurried down the narrow path next to Brazenose and opened the door of St. Mary's to a blast of hot air. His spectacles steamed up. He stopped in the narthex and wiped them on the tail of his muffler, but they clouded up again immediately. "The vicar's looking for you," Colin said. He was wearing a jacket and shirt, and his hair was combed. He handed Dunworthy an order of service from a large stack he was holding.
"I thought you were going to stay at home," Dunworthy said.
"With Mrs. Gadsden? What a necrotic idea. Even church is better than that, so I told Miss Taylor I'd help carry the bells over."
"And the vicar put you to work," Dunworthy said, still trying to get his spectacles clear. "Have you had any business?"
"Are you joking? The church is crammed." Dunworthy peered into the nave. The pews were already full, and folding chairs were being set up at the back. "Oh, good, you're here," the vicar said, bustling over with an armful of hymnals. "Sorry about the heat, it's the furnace. The National Trust won't let us put in a new fused air, but it's nearly impossible to get parts for a fossil fuel. At the moment, it's the thermostat that's gone wrong. The heat's either on or off." He fished two slips of paper out of his cassock pocket and looked at them. "You haven't seen Mr. Latimer yet, have you? He's supposed to read the benediction."
"No," Dunworthy said. "I reminded him of the time."
"Yes. Well, last year he muddled things and arrived an hour early." He handed Dunworthy one of the slips of paper. "Here's your scripture. It's from the King James this year. The Church of the Millennium insisted on it. But at least it's not the People's Common like last year. The King James may be archaic, but at least it's not criminal."
This ends side one of cassette 7. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.